sort of, while I'm up here rambling on every now and again, I stumble across something important, and it's usually stuff that's in there. So even if you don't hear the frequency my voice is on, the real information is still in the packet. So you can read that at your leisure, and you've got room in there to write notes and things like that. The schedule for the rest of the week, tomorrow we're going to take a hike to 10 Mile Falls, or as far along the 10 Mile Falls Trail as you would like to accompany us. The first stop that we'll be at for quite a while is right behind Chalet 1 and Chalet 2. And then there's a little bit of a hill that we walk up to get onto the trail, but once we're on the trail, that's a wheelchair accessible trail. So it's wide and it's reasonably flat and it's good walking, and the only person who's going to trip or fall is going to be me, because I have a tendency to do that. And again, that we'll sort of walk and talk and do geology and look at beauty and experience community and arm wave and problem solve together. And any point along there where you've had enough, you can continue. You can come back and walk back here and come have some lunch. We'll probably try to beat the clock a little bit. So when the bell rings for snack bar tomorrow at 10:30, push these young stinking Lutherans out of the way, get your grub, and then come meet out on the ark. How about we do it that way? Does that work?
Yes.
All right.
We think we'll put an announcement.
Don't say that thing about pushing the Lutherans out of the way. Keep that in. You haven't started recording yet, have you?
No.
Okay, excellent. Just keep that between us. That's what you should do. And then on Friday, what I'm hoping to arrange is a bus ride for whoever wants to go up to what Holden calls the third level, and what in the minor remediation we would call the West Waste Rock Pile, which is where the water is coming out of the mine right now, and it's a good vantage point to overlook what we can of the mine site itself and look up the valley and see that picture that I took a couple of days ago with the big U-shaped valley that's so gorgeous. And I will talk a little bit about, mostly about the mine investigation and a little bit about the remediation. Remember, I came here for the first time in 1997 knowing nothing about Holden Village, knowing nothing about this building, knowing about what was going on the other side of the creek. And I've been here a bunch of times and know a fair amount of the technical information, particularly on groundwater, and a little bit of the history of how we got to where we are. And I think I know a little bit about how things are going to move forward into the remediation. There, Chuck and Steph are going to host a question and answer period one of these days, and it's on the schedule. I don't know precisely when it is. That will be much more updated and inside information than I have.
Thursday.
About 3 years ago, I had all the inside information. I don't anymore. So, and again, that's we're trying to coordinate that with the mine remediation people so that we can go up and do that safely. If for some reason that falls apart, we'll probably just go down to the footbridge. We'll hike rather than take the bus, and we'll go walk to some place that we can, and we'll look around, and I'll tell you what I know. So that's the upcoming schedule. Okay, so we have a few folks who haven't been here yet. Even though you've just come from snack bar, if you read what it says on the kiosk or what it says in your set of handouts, it does say something in there about cookies today. These are not just cookies. This is a geological training aid, as will become clear in 10 or 15 minutes.
So don't eat our cookies right away?
If you don't eat your cookie until we get to the part of the geology, then you can have two cookies.
Whoa.
We're going to run that test, that psychological test that they run on the kids to see. And I got two things. So.
I think you should start with the cookies right there.
So the idea is to hold on to them?
Well,
do not eat it until...
If one of you
All right.
We've done a big experiment with this thing.
Thanks so much for that. Now, thanks. I'll fire it up and we'll go.
Deferred gratification is not a file.
All right. There's plenty.
I can pass.
All right, so for those of you who haven't been here yet, my name is Don Coberly. If you want to call me Donald, you can. If you want to call me Don, you can do that too. While this big truck is passing by, we'll just take a deep breath. I'll have a drink. And this is the third and last lecture I will give this week on basic geology. I try to be as non-technical as I can, because you will see by my choice of geology training aids. We've talked, the Monday night session was essentially my commercial, and we had beer to try and draw people in. Yesterday, we talked about some basic concepts of geology, some laws of geology, and we had licorice. Today we're going to talk about rocks and have cookies. Tomorrow we'll go do a hike and have more licorice. And then Friday, I don't know what I'll do for Friday. You'll be on the bus and so you'll kind of be trapped. So this, probably the best geology lecture you will attend all week. I was in Copenhagen a few years ago and I saw this sign on a building in Copenhagen saying probably the best beer in town. And I thought that was a little bit of what you, if my ad campaign dudes brought me that, I'd say I need better ad campaign dudes, right? Because I would want to say definitely the best beer in town or definitely the best beer on the planet. But what I understand from later on is that in Denmark, this is about as cocky as you can get without poorly. So, and I also hold out the belief as a consultant, which is what I do in the real world, I sometimes get held responsible for the things I actually say. So it's quite possible that you'll meet a geologist here in the village who'll give you a better lecture than I will. So I don't want to cut out that possibility. Okay, this is going to be a quick run through. This is yesterday's talk that took 60 minutes, given in 10 minutes, so I'm going to have to speak even faster, and I cut out all of the really superfluous junk I showed you yesterday. And so here we are. We have one fundamental concept of geologic forces and shape what we can see. And if you don't ever do any geology or study any other geology, this is the one thing I want you to keep in mind. What everything we see on the surface of the planet, except for meteorite impacts, is due to the interplay between two things, the constructive geologic forces, mountain building, that we use plate tectonics as our best explanation of the way the continents move around on the surface and bump into each other, the San Andreas Fault, or India has smashed into Southeast Asia and created the Himalayan Mountains. Constructive forces. They may seem destructive in the moment, but it makes the planet, makes the surface of the planet taller. And then destructive forces, particularly erosion. So everything, that if there's one concept that you should always keep in mind about, here's the world that we see, what's going on, that's the base that you should always go back to. Why are there constructive geologic forces? The Earth is hot in the center and cold at the outside. Heat flows from hot to cold. I've said before that geology is common sense. Everybody knows heat flows from hot to cold. You didn't have to go to college to learn that. The heat flow sets up convection cells and moves the solid crust around the surface of the Earth. Yesterday I had my lava lamp out here to show that sort of bubbling up with the lamp in the middle and the lamp at the bottom being hot, being cold at the top, material would be brought up. Your packet has a diagram of what we think the cross-section of the Earth looks like. We, of course, haven't been here to see that it's the core is probably largely iron. We think there's also some nickel in there, but the computer models that we use that have, and the way that we think we know this is by seeing how earthquake waves travel. The computer models that have an iron-nickel core give the best correlation to the observations that we make. The mantle is silicate rocks. I didn't talk about this yesterday. Silicate, mostly silica, with iron, magnesium, and aluminum. And then on the crust, there's a little bit more information there. Here is a diagrammatic representation of one of those convection cells. Hot here, cold there. When you put a pan of water on the stove and it starts to boil, you'll sometimes see this. So it's that upward motion and then outward motion that has a tendency to drag the plates with the continents attached to them and move them around. That's why we see what we see. Constructive forces are building the planet up, making the mountains higher. What happens when the mountains get higher? They get put into the environment. The environment, what the environment does, I'll tell you a little bit more in a little bit. I'll say this again. I think of the environment as a giant rock tumbler. Bring rocks up. What the environment tries to do is to wear the mountains down. Wind, water, and ice are what we are the main agents. The higher the rocks get raised, the higher the rocks get raised, the mountains are raised, the more effect the environment can have. So that over at 10 Mile Falls, where the gradient of the creek is very steep, you have waterfalls that have a lot of energy, and they're more effective at wearing the mountains down. Railroad Creek has a slightly less gradient, slightly smaller gradient, so there's less energy involved there, so it has less impact than 10 Mile Falls does. One of the big erosional agents are glaciers. This is one of the pictures that isn't mine. But what you're sitting in and what I'm standing in right now is a big glacial valley. There was glaciers historically up the valley, headed down that way, dumped into the bigger glacier that carved Lake Chelan, that headed that way, that dumped into the bigger glacier that carved the Columbia River Gorge. Okay, that's the basics of geology right there. Now, how are we going to study geology in the 5 hours that we spend together, and then what I think you should take away from you? Geology is an observational science. It's written up there, one of the three words down there that I think is fairly important. Observation. We don't sit down with a pad of paper in a lab and do geology calculations. We very rarely do geology experiments like your physics experiments where you put the car up on the top of the inclined plane and you see how far it runs out at the end. In some cases, we'll do experiments, but those are fairly technical and they're once we've done a whole bunch of this first stuff. Observation. Then, once we've made some observations, we make some interpretations. We say, this is what we see. How did it get that way? Well, this is what I think. What do you think? Well, this is what I think. We sit around and we arm wave, and we talk and we drink beer, and we come to some conclusion, and then we say, well, if that's the case, this is what we should also see. Let's go look for that thing. And if we go find it, our hypothesis has been confirmed, and we pat ourselves on the back, and then somebody comes along and blows that out of the water, so now we've got to come up with a different idea. So, and what we're trying to do in the end is make interpretations or advance hypotheses about the geologic makeup and history of a place or an area. In your case, you've solved a puzzle and you can feel good about that. In my case, as a consultant, I've pleased a client and I've made a bunch of money. If the reason that you're in this is because you think you're going to find a gold mine out there and you're actually smarter than any of us and you do find your gold mine, then you get rich, right? That'd be another reason you could do it. You don't have to. Okay. This is a slide that I've shown 6 times already. You can observe a lot just by watching. All right, we have 5 guiding principles or laws. Yesterday I made the analogy to these sort of being the rules of grammar in geology. The rocks, the single specific rocks, or the rock outcrops, or the landforms, those are the words. how do we put those words together into some coherent picture we can see? The first one of those is the principle of least astonishment. It comes out of a philosophical comment. You can read that. The important part is the big orange stuff at the bottom. The simplest explanation is usually the correct one. When we're faced with a number of explanations, we should always default back to the simplest one first. Maybe it's not right. Most of the time it will be. Geologists that I worked with from the University of Arizona said, oh yeah, we call that the principle of least astonishment. And I think that's a simple way to think about that is, wait a minute, I have these two hypotheses. One of them's pretty straightforward. The other one's incredibly astonishing. Which should we go with? Here's the slide I showed yesterday. Again, it's possible that the cat crept under the 6 rolls of toilet paper without tipping them over and then was so tired that the cat fell asleep. It's less astonishing, and therefore the hypothesis we should go with is that the cat fell asleep and then somebody piled the toilet paper on top of it. All right. Principle of uniformitarianism. The present is the key to the past. You can look in perhaps the textbook that I had out yesterday, Putnam's Geology, and see this photo and see this texture of this material from a Hawaiian volcano that someone was there to watch and take a picture of. And you can see you can make an observation and you can get that picture in your mind. Or you can go on a website, a blog that I visit fairly regularly, and pull this photo down, which is a real-time photo of that same process occurring. Here are those ropes in the process of cooling, where 6 inches away it hasn't started to cool yet. So when we see something like this that is some hundreds of thousands or millions of years old, and we see that same pattern, we go, oh, I think I know what that's from. You could attribute it to something else, but that's going to be more astonishing. Present is the key to the past. This is a cut that Railroad Creek has made up by the ball field. And we see these horizontal layers, thin layers of material. I've told you, because I believe it, because I think it's right, that those are lake sediments that were deposited up by the ball field. In our list of questions up there, we have appending questions that said, how do we get a lake at the ball field? Let's put that aside for the moment. But these are lake sediments that have formed recently, and we can go see them. So we make the assumption that these same sorts of thin layers that are horizontal are of fine-grained material, they're probably either lake or ocean sediments as well. We don't have to invoke that an ancient glacier worked the way a lake does now. That's too astonishing. If we have time at the end, we'll talk about, or maybe tomorrow on the hike, we'll talk about one of the things you guys should be thinking about, if you want to do good on the quiz tomorrow, is how do we get a lake at the ball field, right? I've told you that that's the case. I believe that's what the evidence shows. As we start to think geologically, you have to say, how did that happen? All right. If we got time at the end, we'll come back to that. The law of original horizontality. And again, these are in your handout packet, and you can read them more at your leisure. The bottom thing, and this has been edited since yesterday, when we find sedimentary rocks that are unflat, they're tilted or they're deformed some way, we need to explain why. Because in their original, as they were originally deposited, they were deposited flat or nearly so. That's what that whole set of bullet points sort of leads us to, and the rationale for why that is. Those lake sediments that are in the cut bank up there they may be at 3 degrees off the horizontal. We don't worry about that. But if we see rocks that are at 45 degrees off the horizontal, these rocks didn't get laid down like this. That's the entire point. So if we see these in the field, we have to say how'd they get that way. Any questions? Yeah, while I'm drinking.
Are there 3 or 4 most common ways in which the rocks get tilted? And if so, are they in the handout, or could you tell it to us?
There is one most common way that the rocks get tilted. And are you going to go on the hike tomorrow?
I hope to, but that's up in the air.
If you come on the hike tomorrow, I'll tell you how. And if not, I'll tell you over a cup of coffee. How about that? The law of superposition, the oldest stuff is on the bottom. This is stolen from yesterday's talk. This concept applies not only to geology, but also to cake assembling, newspaper recycling, and laundry. You may think that's an odd collection of things. It makes perfect sense to me, which is why this is one of the only places I teach, because if I tried to do that at a university somewhere, they'd say I got off my medication or put me back in the economics department where I belong or something like that. In this case, the idea is if you bake a cake, you put the bottom layer down, and then you frost it, and then you put the next layer on top of it, and then you frost that, and you put the next layer on top of that, and then you frost that. We can entertain the other hypothesis, which is you put four toothpicks down and put the second layer on the toothpicks, and then you frost that, and then you put the third layer down, and then you frost that, and then you slide the first layer in underneath the second and third layer, and then somehow you get the frosting in there. But that's astonishing, so we're going to discount that. The other analogy that I used yesterday was my laundry basket. And good thing I've done laundry, huh? Here is a bunch of laundry out of my laundry basket, and this or one of its companion red golf shirts was at the bottom, and then there was a green golf shirt on top of it, and then a brown pair of pants, tan pants on top of it, and then another different red golf shirt on top of that, and then a blue golf shirt. And so the least astonishing hypothesis is this was the first shirt that I wore since the last time I did laundry and threw it in the bottom of the basket. I'm not a 16-year-old boy anymore, so I don't just leave my stuff laying on the floor and then dump it all in there just before mom comes in the room. I actually throw my stuff in there when I'm done using it. So the hypothesis, the hypothesis that we're going with is this is the shirt I wore longest ago, and then sometime after that I wore that shirt, and then I probably wore this pair of pants with both shirts because tan goes with both red and green. And right, everybody see how that stacks up? The other point that I made was you will probably all assume that I wore this shirt on a day, Monday, and then this one on Tuesday, and then that was the Wednesday shirt. That's a reasonable assumption, but we don't have any information to not know that this was the shirt that I wore all for February. And then come the 1st of March, I changed into my March shirt with the coming of spring in Portland. You know, you want to go into green. All this can tell us is relative age between these events. It doesn't say anything about the specific age of when did these things happen. Or, I hadn't thought of this before, I could have worn this for all of February, and someone had said, you need to up your turnover rate. And so I could have, then this would have been Tuesday, March 1st, and then Wednesday, March 2nd, right? There's no reason why each of these things has to represent the same time increment. All we know is this happened first, and then this and that. We don't know when they happened, and we don't know how long they took. If we take that back into the geology realm, here are these lake sediments piled one on top of another on top of another on top of another. My belief is this is older. This was the first thing that happened, or this happened before this layer was laid down, or that layer was laid down. I don't know whether this happened a billion years ago or 50,000 years ago. I just know this happened before that. And I don't know that this took, that usually what we'll see in lake sediments is it's a seasonal thing. With the spring runoff every year, you'll get a new layer. So if you're really diligent and you're fortunate, you can sort of count these things like tree rings. But we can't assume that. What we can tell from this picture, what I think we can tell from this picture, is older or younger, not a billion years ago, and not one season for every layer. Because geology is tricky sometimes, and this law of original or the law of superposition says oldest is on the bottom, we need to be a little more diligent about that and convince ourselves to say which way is up. Why is this important? We see rocks in the field in this orientation. There are really two choices. One is that those rocks have been tilted up from down right and tilted up, in this case, probably 45 degrees. There's another hypothesis, which is tilted up through 90 degrees and overturned, in which case our law of superposition now gets reversified. My new word for the day. So we have to use some tricks and tips to see and see what field evidence is there is to say, can we tell that? And here's some information. Curved surfaces usually bow downward rather than upward. In your set of handouts are a number, there's one whole page of additional sort of tricks and tips. We can talk more about those tomorrow while we're on the hike. But one of those things is if you see these curved surfaces, and I'll highlight those with some red lines, those should bow downward in a normal sequence. Again, going back to our constructive versus destructive forces, if it were reversed and there were these little humps out in the world, erosion tries to take those humps down and flatten them. So in this case, older getting younger. We believe that this package is in the right orientation or the original orientation. Bigger particles grading into bigger particles becoming smaller particles, we believe that that's in upward orientation. Right side up is what we call it, rather than upside down. Cross-cutting relationships. We're almost to the end of the basic rules of geology and almost to where we can have our cookies. Okay, an igneous rock fault or other geologic feature must be younger than any rock across which it cuts. This was the analogy that I used yesterday from the real world, where there are two events here. One is someone with some sort of equipment went back and forth enough times to build a road, and then someone else put up either power or phone line. Which thing happened first? So that you don't feel stressed about today, we agreed yesterday that the road was probably the first thing to happen, and then somebody came along and put the power line along, including the one power pole right in the middle of the line, or right in the middle of the road. So in the farming world of wherever this is from, the road was event one, the power line was event two. The younger thing cut the older thing, right? Translate that into the geology world. Here is another picture, probably blown up from the one that I had shown you before, from a picture nearby, a rock outcrop nearby. And here is this one the one bed that stands out the most, or does to my eye anyway. But here's another thin layer right here. And you see, when you try to go all the way across, it isn't there anymore. And what in the geologic world, what has happened is that there's been a fault that has cut that. So older is laying down the beds, younger is the fault happening. Any questions? Geology is common sense. Is there anything about this that isn't common sense? Okay. A brief note on inclusions. The thing that is included is older. The thing that does the including is younger. What are the inclusions? The M&Ms and the chocolate chips. Did the M&Ms and chocolate chips get made before the cookies got made? Yes, they did. Right? Do we know anything about when the chocolate chips were made? Before the dough, before the cookies were baked. Everybody get it? Is this reasonable? This is a non-geology idea on inclusions. Holy cow, that happened by itself. This is a piece of core that we drilled up in 2008. From right down the road here, down by Sven's Bridge, where they're working right now. And these black bits that are in here are the inclusions in this lighter material. Therefore, we know one thing. Older stuff, younger stuff. Billion years old? 50 million years old? No idea. We just know older or younger. Included material, older, stuff that does including, younger. Included material, older, stuff that does the including, younger.
Can I ask a question? If you go back a couple slides, I'm kind of confused to that picture with the, that one. So there, I thought that the light gray stuff was the young, and then blacker was the old. Or is that a different principle, or were you trying to explain something different here? Because I thought you were saying that the lighter stuff cut into the old, so the lighter is younger.
Mm.
So what's the difference between the two? They seem opposites to me.
Thank you. What a great point. In this case, this is, and I don't know if this is going to answer the question very well, this is Banff, Canada. These are sedimentary rocks. These are laid down. And this entire package, everything that we can see in the photo, my guess would be this is the first layer that was laid down. And then this one was laid down on top of it, and this one, and they're different materials. And maybe, as I talk through the rest of the session, this will become a little bit more clear about sedimentary rocks. These were all laid down the same way over some long period of time. And if we had seen this at some point in the deep past, we would have been able to track this layer all the way across the picture.
Okay, so it's illustrating something different.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. This is, in this case, that layer was truncated by something. In this case, it's a fault, which is why we don't see it. So all of these units are older, getting progressively younger as we go to the top of the picture. And then this thing came along and broke this linear feature, and so it's therefore younger. In this case, in the law of inclusions, this is a different type of rock. This is igneous rock, which we'll talk about right quick here. And so this stuff is molten material. This is all, originally it was all molten material. This stuff came in and melted and pulled this stuff down into it, and therefore it's the inclusion. So if you can hold that confusion for the next few minutes, hopefully something I'll tell you will make it a little more clear.
It's already more clear.
Okay. So now we have these laws and rules and basic ideas, and we're going to go out and we're going to do geology. And here's a picture that's in your handout set. And our idea, we talked about it yesterday, about how would we go about looking at this road cut on I-70 in Colorado and trying to make some geologic sense of it. This is precisely what we'll do tomorrow out in the field when we can go put our hands on the rocks.
So can I ask a question?
Yes.
So if we're talking about the cookie, this is an igneous example.
Exactly.
If we're talking about sedimentary, if this were sedimentary as opposed to igneous, then that would be younger and this would be older. So the cookie is really an igneous.
The cookie example is an igneous example. The cake is a sedimentary example.
Yes.
How about that?
That's good. Thank you.
All right. Historically, I've given these sessions sort of backwards to what they are now, where we talked about rocks first, and maybe I should go back to that way of thinking about things. There are three main types of rocks: sedimentary, metamorphic, and igneous. And it would be your geologic life moving forward will be easier if you can keep these three in mind. In the forestry world, the first cut is between deciduous and conifers. Yeah, okay. Leafy trees, needly trees. To bring that into the geology world, there are three different kinds: sedimentary, metamorphic, and igneous. There's the definitions of each. Sedimentary, composed of solid grains called sediment, transported by a fluid, either air, water, or water as ice. Think of sediment in your wine. That's solid material transported by a fluid. Metamorphic, I think of
metamorphosis, butterfly, caterpillar to a butterfly. The process in geology isn't nearly that complicated, but the idea of change is what is important. And a metamorphic rock is one that's changed by temperature and or pressure. Igneous is the stuff that's solidified from molten material. Let's talk about sedimentary rocks first. The reason to do that is because 70% of the rocks we can see at the surface are sedimentary. So if someone asks, what kind of rock is it, my first guess will always be sedimentary, and I'll be right 70% of the time, just by statistics. In this case, where I'm at a disadvantage because there's not a lot of sedimentary rock here. There's metamorphic and igneous rock here in the valley. But two subtypes, clastic, which is the main kind that we have, and then chemical. Primary chemical sedimentary rock is called limestone. The clastic rocks often take the name of the size of the particles. So a rock made out of sand is called sandstone. Rock made out of silt is called siltstone. In clastic sedimentary rocks, the sediment grains are lithified, they're turned to stone, usually by pressure of later sediment being piled on top. So that in that one picture where my buddy Fred was picking up the bucket or filling the bucket of water, that's what he was doing out there. Those rocks that are at the bottom, or the rocks now that are at the bottom, were laid down as lake sediments like the stuff up here. And then the next year, another layer came down on top of it. And the next year, another layer came down on top of it. So, well, how do you turn that into rock? If that layer, next layer, weighs about what a sheet of paper does, put a sheet of paper on it, right? Nothing big happens. Put a million sheets of paper on top of somebody, and now you're squashing them, right? So those rocks that were at the bottom had 500 feet, and that unit is probably 3,500 or 4,000 feet thick. 4,000 feet of sediment on top of a rock will squash it down pretty hard and turn it into stone. Here's a tip that I'll break a little bit today as we're continuing on. We should think more about what the rocks have to tell us rather than what to call them. If you want to learn the names of all the geologic rocks, you can do that. It's a one quarter course in community college. And then you can come back and remind me of all of those because I've forgotten 90% of them. They're not really important to me. What I care about is what is this thing telling us? Now I'll throw some names in here as we're going along. But again, I don't care. You know, deciduous and coniferous trees, trees with leaves and trees with needles, you could call them coniferous and deciduous, or you could call them Democrat and Republican. I don't particularly care about that label. What I care about is if I'm out in the forest and I see some trees with needles on them, what does that tell me? It tells me I'm in a generally cooler climate, or it tells me I'm on the south slope of a valley or something like that. Geology is hard enough for me. I can't do forestry at the same time. But if that were the case, that's what I would care about. The fact that it was called a deciduous tree, or a larch, or a birch, or a oak, or a cedar, that's, if you're a forester, that's key stuff. At the first level, I don't see that as being terribly important. The igneous metamorphic sedimentary, that's a differentiation that I think we should all try to be able to make. When you get much past that, I'm not sure that there's a lot of use in it. Okay, the observations. One of the things we've been pounding on for the last few days is the first thing we do is we make observations. Then we make our interpretations and our hypotheses. What do we observe about a clastic sedimentary rock? Again, this is the thing that's made out of particles. And you could just, you've got the picture there, but if you want to see the actual grains that I have, you can imagine these loose grains that are in here right now being turned into a rock and being cemented together, and now that's the rock that we're confronted with. What are these observations we could make? Rounded versus angular particles. One particle type versus many. Is there one thing in there or are there many things in there? In the two sort of extreme examples I have the one jar of sand there that you have the picture of that's all the same thing. It's all the same size, it's all the same color, turns out to be all the same material, it's all rounded. The other jar is what I think of as being subangular. There's lots of different rock types in there. There's a fair amount of variability in the size of the fragments, right?
Does that anybody disagree with my observations? I'm willing to entertain that. And then, if we wanted to look at it into it even further, we could figure out what are the bits and pieces that make up those rock fragments. Here's that. Here's a giant picture of that same thing, and we could look at that again. But again, all the same stuff to our eye, all reasonably almost essentially the same size, all rounded or sub-rounded, and then greater variety in size, greater variety, more sharp pieces, angular pieces, and a variety of different appearances to our eye, a number of different colors in there. Here's another picture. This is from some recent stuff I did in Australia. And again, the point here would be we can look at these and we can see there is some range of grain sizes here or fragment sizes here. There's lots of fairly angular stuff, right? There's a little bit of rounded material. Again, these are the observations we make. If we're doing geology and we're getting paid for it, we write these things down in our notebook or we take this photograph so that we could come back at the end of the day and throw it down on the table and say, oh, this stuff all looks angular to me. And someone would then point out and say, well, here's a piece that looks to be rounded. And there, you know, and we would come in community and we would come to some, hopefully we'd come to some consensus, or there'd be one stick in the mud who'd say, you guys are all wrong, it's all really angular. Geologically speaking, the environment is a big rock tumbler. I said this the first time in 2002, I still believe it. As rocks are transported farther away from the source, i.e. spend more time in the rock tumbler, what happens? The angular pieces become more rounded. Those pieces get, you think of something in the stream, it's getting pounded and rolled down the stream on top of other rocks, and those you put a cube in something and try to turn it over, you bust the corners off. You put a pool ball in something and roll it, nothing breaks off because it's already rounded. All the sharp bits have been busted off already. The rock clast pieces tend to become the same size. The big pieces smash into each other and bust each other up, and the little pieces sneak through the holes in between them, and so over time, the size becomes more consistent. The less resistant rock or mineral types become less and less, and the more resistant rock or mineral types remain. That stuff gets physically abraded to a point that it's small enough that now the water can interact with it and chemically finish it off, and it's all gone. So that one, the one jar of sand, this stuff, is all quartz, which is the hardest general material that we have on the planet. It's all the same size. It's all rounded or sub-rounded. And therefore, we would say this stuff has spent the most time in the rock tumbler, right? If given a choice between these two, I would think, I'm going to tell you, more and less, right? But that's the conclusion you would all come to straight away anyway. And so think about in Railroad Creek when a rockfall happens and the stuff just comes off into the top of Copper Basin. When that stuff hits the ground and busts into a million pieces, all of those pieces are sharp and they're different sizes and they're different dimensions, things like that. And then as you spend more, those things may roll down the hill, get into the creek, get transported by the creek. As you go farther away from the source, what happens in that rock will change. Right? So when you see, if we would see a rock that was this pure sand and now it's just all stuck together, we'd go, holy cow, this has been in the rock tumbler for a long time. We're probably pretty far away from where this stuff originated. And clast pieces reflect what? Remember, we're on tape.
Whatever is up the order of
that. What's that?
Whatever is up the order of that.
Where did you get that from?
Me.
No, so again, if we go out in the creek right now and we look at the rocks in the creek, how many of those came from Buffalo, New York? None. How many of them came from Denmark? None. How many of them came from Indonesia? One, because I brought it here in 1994 and 1996, after having been in Indonesia, and I threw it on the ground so that someday some geologist who's up here out rock hounding is going to go,
the heck is a singular?
True stories. And one of the ways that we in the community are smarter than me is I've been posing this question off and on for years, having my ideas. Everything came from in the valley, right? So everything we see here should be from in the valley. We could go around to the edge of the mountains and say, this is the end of the world and everything that... Well, no, that's not the case, because in geologic time, the glacier has come from outside the valley over what we think of as now as being the crest and brought material in here. So we could see stuff in the creek that we wouldn't see in any of the mountains around here. That's one true thing that someone in the course has said, other than me, that I'd never thought about. There's another one, which is perhaps the rock units that have been eroding away all this time, those rock units that some of the stuff that we see now, they're all gone, right? We don't see it on the sides of the mountains anymore, but we can still see some of it in the stream. So there are ways that we can get material that's not from nearby, but we have to come up with a fairly thoughtful, more thoughtful than I am usually, the way, how do we get it there? Questions? Observations. Older, less time in the rock tumbler, more time in the rock tumbler. I can talk at length at some point about where these things came from. Clastic sedimentary rocks are usually deposited near shore. So these things that we would see, or sandstone that you would see, would be near shore. Chemical sedimentary rocks, particularly limestone, are deposited in deep water. So if we go back to the photo that I took, or that I showed on Monday, to show some other things, this is limestone, we said that, and so this is chemical sedimentary. First off, it's all sedimentary rock, has to be deposited in water. To get this much of it, it has to be in the ocean. There's no lake that's this big. Sharp cliffs, tougher rock. I'll tell you right now, limestone is a tougher rock. Sand and shale, not as dense, not as tough. It erodes more easily and makes slopes. Cliff, slope, cliff. What I've just told you, deep water, shallow water, deep water. Right? One step beyond our observations and now into our interpretations. Deep water, shallow water, deep water, that's an interpretation. What's the next thing we do? Hypothesize, right? How did we get deep water, shallow water, deep water? And now we're getting into the guts of geology. You can take an entire quarter's class on sedimentary petrology, so that if you wanted to expand what I've just talked about in 15 minutes into 30 hours, you can do that and really know this stuff and answer that question fairly simply. We may talk about that tomorrow on the hike, or I'll be glad to entertain that outside of right now, but for right now, I'm going to keep moving unless there's a question. This, to me, is one of the ways that geology is a better science than forestry, which was the first thing I went into, is the amount of information that you can glean, or the amount of puzzle solving that you can do based on deciduous versus coniferous or cedar versus elm, to me that seems fairly limited. What we get in the rock world is that third dimension of time, and at some point in the past we have to come up with a defensible reason why what's now in Banff, Canada, at a mile above sea level, was in deep water. And then that same location was in shallow water. We can think conceptually about how do you get something from deep water to shallow water? Either raise the land up or you lower the water down, right? Or maybe some of both. Is there another way to do it? I don't think so. But we think about it some more and we might come up with that. That's the thing, that's as someone who likes to solve puzzles, that's the part that has sort of hooked me into geology. And then because it's really complicated and I can't figure it out, I went into hydrogeology, which is much simpler.
Question?
Yes.
Limestone and sandstone are different in other ways. They're from different material, and aren't their grains different sizes? Does that make any difference in how you think about those?
Well, again, and the, yes, exactly. So the sandstone particles are bigger, right? That's well, let's just take that on faith for the moment. You know, every time I put that in my pocket, it bumps that and we move ahead. So that's one of the things that limits sandstone to being sort of a nearshore occurrence, right? The when where the Mississippi River goes out into the Gulf of Mexico, that current still is slowed down by going into the big lake that we call the Gulf of Mexico. So that current doesn't exist 60 miles offshore. The amount of the size of the particle that can be suspended in water is based on the speed of the water, right? As that water slows down, it deposits that stuff. The biggest fragments, the sandstone, cobbles and boulders get deposited really close to shore and then out to sand. And then limestone, because it's a chemical precipitate, can happen in deep water where there's essentially no current. So yeah, that's another spatial correlation that we can make is this stuff was near shore, right? That it was in shallow water and it had to be near shore. So that, yeah, that's a, again, that's another thing, that's another of our interpretations that we would make, that we'd say, all right, this stuff, deep water, probably out somewhere, unless the edge of the continent were incredibly deep. We don't see that very often. So yeah, now there's more, the observations that we've made, now we have
been major flooding in between that drove the sediments out further before it could settle in.
And now, I'm reeling them in. You start to think geologically. So again, that's at the end of our day out in the field collecting notes, we would come back and we'd sit around the table, sometimes with our beers out, and say, all right, what else does this mean? What else does this mean? Does this picture still hang together? And then somebody will come along and go, yeah, but what about that? And we'll go, oh, crud. We got to come up with a different idea, right? That's the way geology works. Sorry. Not a bad view there in Banff, Canada. If you're ever going to take one geology drive in your life, take the drive from Banff to Jasper. That's another one of the things I'll tell you that I think is true. All right. For now, we think more about what the rocks have to tell us rather than what to call them. Metamorphic rocks are changed. I've already told you that. They're changed by temperature and pressure. The key thing that we try to think about for metamorphic rocks, and again, it's impossible in the moment for me to be able to say, here are the things that you need to know about sedimentary rocks and metamorphic rocks and igneous rocks. With a little bit of information now, the thing we gotta do is go out and look at it. Or the thing you have to do is when you go back down the hill, go to community college and go look at them with somebody else. And here's one of the things I'm gonna pass along is, if I'm the only geology talk you ever go to, you're gonna learn my version of geology. 95% of it's probably pretty good, and 5% of it's complete harebrained stuff. If you go talk to another geologist, they'll tell you a little bit different story, and you'll be able to say, yeah, all of this stuff matches up. That stuff that Don told me was harebrained, but wait a minute, this stuff that geologist Cliff, that's equally crazy. I'm not going to believe that either. So that's where the community comes in, is I live in Australia now. One of the reasons I was brought down there was to help train young hydrogeologists. And every one of them that comes to the field and spends time with me, I say, okay, when you go back to the office, you have to grab the boss by the throat and say, all right, I've heard Don's goofy stories. Now go send me out with somebody else and let me know what they have to say. And there are four or five of us in that group who have a fair amount of experience, and I'd like to go out and be out with other geologists, right? I can tell myself the same story over and over again until I start to believe it, right? Go out with somebody else, and I go, well, here's something, blah, 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 and they go, well, that's crazy. And I go, oh, really? And I go, dang, they're right, so I don't say it anymore, right? So that's the opportunity that you have, is to go out and find other geologists at the community college or in your local community where there's a geology hike being offered. Go listen to what they have to say. or next time Rick Dunning is up here when you're here in the summer. He knows way more about this valley than I do. Sedimentary rock made of clay-sized particles is called shale. Sorry about that, it's not really important. As that rock becomes denser and harder, as more stuff gets piled on top of it, it turns into slate. I've got a piece of slate here from near Banff. Slate, you can think of, because that's what we make pool tables out of, right? If we had a piece of shale here, it wouldn't be nearly this dense and it wouldn't be nearly this hard. You set a mile worth of dirt on top of this stuff and you squash the living heck out of it, and now you get slate. If you now start to press on something and push on it for an extended period of time, we showed the fold idea yesterday. One of the ways that rocks react to stress is to fold. Another thing that they tend to do is reorient internally in the same direction, especially under directed pressure. We call this rock schist, which we always strive to pronounce very, very carefully. And under increasing or longer pressure, what will happen is the rock will no longer just sort of get wavy and shiny, but the minerals will actually separate into separate layers and become banded. I got a picture of that in a moment, and become a rock that we call gneiss, which is just like the word gneiss. This is rock, and we will see this tomorrow if we go on the hike. These are layers because we see, to me this look, I don't know how to explain it anymore, but I've been looking at layers for 30 years now. The people see the, like, sheets of a page here going, is that in people's visual bank now? Like the rock, like the layers down at the ball field, only if we go and pick up a piece of this rock, it's going to be much more of the density and the strength of that stuff. So I will tell you that this is metamorphosed. It started to change. It started to become more dense sediments of some kind. And here's another rock from somewhere around the village. I took this picture last year where we start to get these wavy surfaces. And you guys who live here have seen this stuff all over. If you've been here a while, you've seen this stuff all over the places. And almost we're starting to see some of this banding. So again, why do we care about this? Is that if we find this thing in place, if we find a big slab of it that we think is connected to the world, we can measure the orientation of this, the lining up of things, and we can now translate that back to this orientation. And the only way, again, to repeat what we said yesterday, the only way we get this orientation is to push on something. And by knowing the orientation of the orientation from me to Otto, there's only one way to get this orientation, and that's to push perpendicular to it, right? If I push corner to corner here, I get a different fold, heads off that direction. So by taking the fold as our guide, now we go back to say this was the direction of the geologic force for a fold that goes that way. This was the direction of the geologic force that goes towards Otto. We can glean that same sort of information out of this rock if we can see it in place rather than sitting out free like it is, because sitting out free like it is, we could go take a bunch of measurements on it, and then Holden would say it's in the way and get a piece of equipment and move it to some other place and the orientation would be different, and so we don't do that. I'm going to run over about 10 minutes, sorry.
What's the white line in the slate?
The white line in the slate is, I don't know, silica probably. I'll look at it. It's probably silica or something that is basically silica. I'll look at that. That's why I went into hydrogeology, is questions like that. Igneous rocks. All the rocks that we see started their life as an igneous rock, started from the molten state, cooled, were raised up into the environment, got worn down, got turned into sediment, and are now a sedimentary rock. sedimentary rock got deposited out in the ocean. The oceans collided. That rock was put under pressure. Now it's metamorphic rock. You put it under enough pressure and temperature, and it remelts, and now it's an igneous rock again. So there is a rock cycle for these three things that, if you want to spend some time thinking about, you can see. How do you turn an igneous rock into a sedimentary rock? You put it up in the environment at Yosemite Valley. Those big domes are igneous rocks that were molten and then cooled. Now they're up. Now they're being worn down. They're being turned into sediment. Now we have a sedimentary rock. We can talk about that. From the igneous rocks, and again, it's hard. I would like to be able to go out with each of you and spend 10 minutes and say, this layered stuff, again, the pagey stuff that we see, that's sedimentary. Again, if you guys get that, you're a long way away. It doesn't help you much here in the valley because there's not a lot of this stuff here. Igneous rock we'll look at tomorrow, and we'll see what igneous is as the stuff melts, as the molten stuff cools, those grains sort of interlock. And that's how you can tell that it's an igneous rock. Igneous rocks, what is the crystal size? That's the thing that we think of when we think about sedimentary rocks. Grains, rounded or angular. Different sizes are same. Different materials are same. Things like that. When we get to igneous rocks and we identify it as igneous, the key thing that we can tell most quickly is what's the size of the crystal that makes up the rock. Again, we'll look at that again tomorrow, or if you're not going on the hike, grab me and we'll go look in at the wall right here and I'll show you. Hawaiian lava and Yosemite Valley granite are both igneous rocks. They each reflect a cooling history and unique chemical composition. The Hawaiian volcanoes, if you go and you try to find the crystals in them, you can't because they're too small. They're too small because they cool essentially immediately in geologic time. What got extruded out yesterday on the island of Hawaii is now rock. There's no time for the crystals to grow. The Yosemite Valley granites cooled at 2 or 3 miles below ground surface, so they cooled very slowly and allowed those crystals time to grow. So, small to no crystals, quick cooling, Hawaiian volcano. Bigger crystals, deeper cooling, more time for the crystals to grow. Common sense? Small crystals. What if we see both big and small crystals? There are rocks, and there's one over in the museum next door that has big and small crystals. How do we get that?
Metamorphic.
That would be one way to have it happen. That's true. Another hypothesis that we could entertain is that for some reason that material was cooling slowly at depth, and then there was a vent that allowed it to come to surface very quickly. So we would find large crystals in a larger mass of small crystals. The large crystals cooled slowly at depth, and then for some reason it blew out or came to surface very quickly, and now that matrix is small crystals. But that's another hypothesis. Those are two things we should entertain. For now, we should think about what the... Types of crystals reflect the chemistry of the mass the rock cooled from. And this is the analogy I came up with last night. The soup you get out of the soup pot can only be made of the stuff you threw in the pot. Right? So if we have a rock I'll show a picture of a rock. Keep in mind right now, this is just information. Light-colored crystals generally are composed more of silica and potassium-bearing minerals. Dark-colored crystals generally have less silica and more iron, magnesium, calcium, and more sodium. The composition is different. So that when we see dark crystals of intermediate grain size, or crystal size in my way of thinking, did they cool fast or slow? Somewhere in between. The black stuff, the dark stuff, probably if we would take a piece of that and send it off to the lab, it would be higher in iron and magnesium and lower in silica. It does, the chemistry of the Earth is very simple. There's 8 elements that make up 90% of what we can see here, silica being the most, silica and oxygen. And so almost all minerals have basically the same building blocks. It's just a difference in percentages. And here's another course that you can take for 30 quarter hours on igneous petrology that will tell you about precisely what each of those things mean. You can, the crystals have different shapes, and you can identify, we could identify things in the field by looking at the angles that the crystals make. And if we had 2 weeks, we'd probably do that in the second week. But can we, these are both igneous rocks. They have that sort of interlocking crystal, and you can see actual crystals in some of these rocks if you look at them with a magnifying glass. They're a little bit different, right? A little bit darker, a little bit lighter. My guess is different soup pot, or something that was already in the soup pot crystallized out, and so what's left is changed, right? You start with a, and this is where my soup pot analogy sort of breaks down. When that material settles out, you've changed what's still in the liquid phase. So in a big melt, what we'll see is a change over the cooling history. Again, here's a, we could look at, and we look at this in the field, and we can point out the specific crystals, and some of them have a certain shape, and now we can tell what mineral they're made out of. Here's the full rock description for that rock. And again, I think about this as, this is what geologists would say to each other, the same way that when Cliff is consulting with another doctor looking at the x-ray of my broken collarbone, there would be scads more information that he would be able to glean from that. But it doesn't change the fact that I had a broken collarbone, right? In this case, talking with other geologists, or talking with geologists who care much more about this than I do, we would say gray to dark gray, color index to 20 to 45, which is a quantitative scale. Medium grain, got that much right. Xenomorphic to hypidiomorphic. Andesine crystals, we would look and we would see that some of the crystals are this mineral that we can call andesine. Biotite and hornblende are anhedral. They're not, they don't have any crystal shape to them at all. Quartz and orthoclase are interstitial. They make the stuff in between those other. Mostly massive but gneissic along the west margin. So there's more information in here to you, you know, at first glance, how much of that is really relevant. My thinking is it light or dark, more silica, more iron and magnesium? And is it small crystal, big crystal, or some of both? Now we know a little bit about rocks and a little bit about some of the rules that help us figure out how the rocks fit with each other. What's next is tomorrow we go for a hike. That's all I'm going to say today.